I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. What do kids from Latin America have in common with kids from Camden, New Jersey? Many of them have to deal with drugs, crime, and violence on a daily basis. And today, advocates and social workers from both areas got together to share experiences and insights. WHYY's Joe Hernandez reports.
High school student Aaron Holmes says he lives in the good part of Camden, but only compared with the absolute worst areas of the city.
Because there's still murders that happen. It's carjackings that used to happen. There's people I knew, too, that lived right up the street from me.
But Holmes got away from that life, thanks in part to an after-school program. At a meeting in North Camden, advocates and social workers from the city and a dozen Latin American cities got together to talk about how to put kids like Holmes on the right track. It was part of a program organized by the State Department that connects industry leaders from other countries to their counterparts in the U.S. Sister Helen Cole, who runs Guadalupe Family Services in Camden, wanted to stress a few ideas she's learned working with at-risk youth.
About having a safe place in the midst of violence, having being able to do whatever we can to educate and have expectations of being educated.
Laura Voitret runs the Providencia Educational Center in Uruguay. Through a translator, she says the main difference between Latin America and the U.S. is that many Latin American social services organizations simply have less to work with.
Now, we do understand that you have more resources right here in the United States to fight it. But at the end, we are realizing that we really are facing exactly the same problem, so we don't feel so lonely, just to say so.
Other participants from countries including Mexico and Nicaragua asked questions ranging from how the community responds to their work in Camden to how the law treats drug possession in the U.S. Camden was the delegation's first stop, but meetings are also set in Cleveland, New Orleans, and Los Angeles. From the New Jersey desk, I'm Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
The annual Philly Pride Parade and Festival take place Sunday in celebration of the city's gay, lesbians, bisexual, and transgender communities. Some 25,000 attendees are expected. From WHYY's Arts and Culture desk, Peter Crimmins reports some disagreement has been brewing within the ranks of the parade.
This year, organizers invited a newly formed club of gay and lesbian police officers to participate in the Pride Parade as grand marshals. The group is called Gay Officers Action League, or GOAL, but an online petition went up denouncing GOAL's inclusion, saying police officers, gay or not, represent an institution that, quote, continues to carry out racist and transphobic violence, and that parade organizers have a, quote, disturbing lack of awareness. It attracted a few hundred signatures. That is palpably ridiculous, says senior advisor for Philly Pride, Chuck Volz.
Oh, there was definitely argument being made that Philly Pride was somehow insensitive to the trans community. And Philly Pride, of any pride organization in the United States, has been the most open proponent of our trans community.
In the end, the gay police officers decided to cool the growing hostility by declining the invitation. This year, two mummers groups will join the Pride Parade, the Trilby String Band and the Murray Comics, without opposition. During last year's New Year's Day parade, some mummers carried signs insulting transgendered people and reportedly assaulted a gay man. The comic club will march but will not be in costume. Rich Porco, president of the comic division, says the decision to join the Pride Parade was done at the last minute.
We never thought we had to, like, show our support or anything like that because we never disallowed anybody from being in the Mummers Parade. And now we want to show that we do support their efforts.
Porco says gays and lesbians have been openly participating in the Mummers Parade for years. However, the date of the Pride Parade, Sunday, conflicts with the annual Mummers Weekend in Wildwood, New Jersey. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump present perhaps the starkest presidential candidate contrast in recent memory. Helping us to count the ways is Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Dave.
Well, let's have at it. What are the biggest differences between the two?
We've done a lot of research about what people think about the candidates themselves, and clearly the candidates have been doing the same research, because when we talk about Donald Trump, the fact that he could be perceived as unstable, as a wild man, is not tethered, being arrogant. Those types of personality characteristics come through in our data from the public. And that's what Hillary Clinton's been picking up on recently in her speeches. So clearly her advisors have said, aha, that's a point to go after for Donald Trump. But when we ask Americans about Hillary Clinton and her personality and what comes to mind first, dishonesty is what comes up top of the list. Actually, that also came at the top of the list back in 08. And clearly the Trump people, Donald Trump himself, are aware of that. And his speeches are going to go after both Hillary and Bill Clinton in terms of their integrity and honesty over the years.
Does that dishonesty cut both ways, though? Could Democrats use that against Donald Trump?
Certainly. We just recently asked Americans about a variety of characteristics and how much they applied to Hillary Clinton and then how much they applied to Donald Trump. And when we say honest and trustworthy, they're both right at 32% and 33%. So there's very little difference in the perceived honesty of both of those candidates at this point. Right now, Dave, you'll be interested to know 26% of Americans, let me repeat the number, 26% of Americans have an unfavorable opinion of both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. And that's a pretty big group of people.
Let's break that down, though, by gender.
Hillary Clinton does better among women than among men, but we think, based on our analyses here, a lot of that just has to do with the fact that she's a Democrat, and Democratic candidates typically do better among women than men, and I'm not sure how much of that is actually due to her historic status as being the first woman to gain a major party nomination in history. Let me be specific on favorables. Of all Americans right now, 42% of women have a favorable opinion of Hillary Clinton, 51% an unfavorable. Men are 8 points lower at 34% favorable. So there is a gender gap there of about 8 points, but that's not unusual. In fact, Dave, when we look only at Democratic women, Hillary Clinton has a 69% favorable, but among Democratic men, she has a 65% favorable. In other words, her gender gap really is a function of the underlying dynamics that Republicans tend to be more male, and Democrats tend to be more female to begin with. So just to reiterate, we're not sure how much of a distinctive factor her gender is over and above what the typical Democratic candidate would have.
To what extent are Americans satisfied with the way things are going?
29% are satisfied, Dave. I've just done a lot of work trying to put that in context. And actually, this has not changed a lot. Some pundits and observers say, oh, Americans are now totally dissatisfied and more so than they have been, and that's why Trump has done well. But we go all the way back to 2007 with roughly the same kind of level of satisfaction, which is not good.
Was that 2007 polling conducted before the housing bubble burst and the onset of the Great Recession?
Yeah, we started to see a decline in satisfaction, right before all of that became starkly evident. Now, some of it was beginning to be known, but we had other problems going on at that time, particularly with the Iraq War and some things that were not economically related. So if you look at the graph, that number started to come down and was very low by the time Barack Obama took office. And it's kind of bounced up and down since then. But if you look back over 89 months now of the Barack Obama administration, satisfaction with the way things are going on average have been quite a bit below what we have seen typically over the history of our asking the question.
Economic anxiety still driving that charge?
Yes, it's the economy, it's the economy, it's the economy. And then a subset of that, jobs. I cannot overemphasize how much Americans are focused on the desire to have more and better jobs. And the third would be dysfunctional government.
Taking it back to square one, does Gallup poll on the extent to which voters think that either Trump or Clinton is best apt to handle those three facets, economy, jobs, and dysfunction in government?
Yeah, we do. On the latter, we don't have a great sense of who would do the better job on that. But on the economy, it is Donald Trump. That's a strength for Trump. He's not overwhelming on that. He does best on things like to bring about change and some things like that. But he touts his business experience, whether or not it's been as successful as he thinks it is. But when you just ask Americans flat out to choose between the two candidates, Trump and Hillary Clinton, on who would do the best job on the economy and on jobs, Trump beats Clinton.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on Newsworks Tonight. Still ahead, a film festival in Philadelphia brings Latino experiences to a wider audience.
You don't have to be from Venezuela to really come and watch Normal. We are in a society now that it's dealing with polar opposites in our political landscape.
Newsworks Tonight continues on WHYY. Welcome back to Newsworks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. Puerto Rican filmmaking figures prominently in this year's Philadelphia Latino Film Festival with stories exploring identity, humor, and cultural displacement. The 14 shorts and 4 full-length movies are the richest offering yet of this 5-year-old festival, which starts today. WHYY's Elizabeth Perez Luna reports.
The Spanish alphabet has 29 letters, and the oddest one is the Ñ. You know, that N with a wavy line on top? It's so characteristic that it has been adopted as a name for a growing segment of the Latino population.
I am an Ñ.
Ñ!
It's a group of people here in the United States that is 16 million strong and growing. A group of people that found themselves stuck between two worlds because they were born in the United States to parents who were born in Spanish-speaking countries.
With her personal documentary, Ñe, filmmaker and blogger Denise Soler Cox wanted to speak for an entire generation of Latinos living between several worlds. She uses a poignant, often humorous tone to tell the story.
Sometimes we don't feel Latino enough, and sometimes we don't feel American enough. But we are both.
For Marangeli Mejia Ravel, a Puerto Rican Ñe herself, and the head of the Philadelphia Latino Film Festival, the selections range from first-person narratives to family dramas, erotic musings, and full-length features, some of which have been presented at Cannes and other international festivals.
One of the beautiful things that it does is that it captures what's happening in communities throughout Latin America now. You don't have to be from Venezuela to really come and watch Normal. We are in a society now that it's dealing with polar opposites in our political landscape.
Mejia is talking about the film Normal, which depicts the deep division in Venezuela's political reality through the plight of an anti-government protester who takes refuge from the police bullets in an old boyfriend's apartment. He is loyal to government. She wants change. The backdrop of most of the films, especially the Puerto Rican entries, is economic unrest. But Marangeli points out that unrest of any kind is a powerful motivator for artists.
I think that at times of crisis is that people really tap into the innovator in them, the entrepreneurial spirit really emerges, and people, you know, excel creatively.
Other films in the festival showcase work from Colombia, the Dominican Republic, and U.S. Latino filmmakers. There's even a film that was presented at the Cannes Film Festival about Peruvian Nisei, Peruvians of Japanese descent.
El otro día cometí una estupidez y créame, yo no...
Ah, el hombre de los chocolates.
The Philadelphia Latino Film Festival starts today and runs through the weekend at both the University of the Arts and the Kimmel Center. Aside from workshops and panels, organizers are making future plans for a permanent venue. The latest idea is to take the films on the road in a traveling showcase that would play all around Pennsylvania. Elizabeth Perez Luna, WHYY News.
Leslie Odom Jr. was growing up in East Loak Lane when he got a tape recorder from his parents at the age of 5. He sang into it for hours on end, and for the next 29 years, he spent time at Philadelphia's Masterman High and Freedom Theater, making his Broadway premiere in the musical Rent, and studied in the celebrated drama program at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh. Sunday night at the Tony Awards, you'll find Leslie Odom a nominee for Best Actor in a Musical for his performance as Aaron Burr in the sensation Hamilton. WHYY theater blogger Howard Shapiro spoke with Leslie Odom Jr. between Hamilton matinee and evening performances.
Leslie, you have probably been in a real whirlwind in the past month since the Tony nominations were announced.
It's a dream come true. This is the literal dream. You want to be something when you're a young actor. You want to be in something that feels like art. You want to be in something that people care about. You know, icing on the cake is to get any kind of recognition for that kind of thing. So this Hamilton is the trifecta. It is really all of my dreams coming true at once.
I read that you began singing into a tape recorder your parents gave you when you were a little guy at 5 years old, almost 30 years ago, in East Oak Lane, where you grew up. And your formal theater training began here in Philadelphia at Freedom Theater. Isn't that correct?
That's right. Freedom Theater started it all, yeah.
When you went to Freedom Theater, were there several things special that you said, you know, I really, really, really want to do this?
Well, to walk in the doors at Freedom Theater at that time, Tom Page was running the program. And to walk in the doors every single day, Tom would stand outside and greet us. And he would say, what's the password? And we would say, I respect myself. And he would say, you're beautiful. So there was a discipline and a pride and a self-reliance. Just taught me all of the best things. You know, I still consider myself a Freedom Theater actor. I'm a proud Freedom Theater actor. I was a kid with a little bit of talent, but Freedom gave me my first dose of discipline, my first dose of craft, and got me thirsty, you know, hungry for more knowledge. And I should also say it was also Philadanko too, Philadelphia Dance Company. Freedom would do this thing where if they would see certain kids that were kind of advancing to a high level, they would send them to Philadanko, who they believed had just a little more resources to give you that really good foundation of technique, you know, dance technique.
Well, it wasn't long before you were on Broadway in Rent. How old were you, 17 or 18 or...?
I was 17. Yeah, I was 16 when I auditioned, and yeah.
And you had been at the time a student at Masterman High, right?
That's right.
In Center City.
I showed up at that Rent audition not expecting to get it. That was not in my mind at all. I just showed up sort of for the experience, and I thought it would take me, you know, maybe 10, 15 years to book the show, so I should start the process now because I really wanted to do it. And somewhere in the middle of that dance audition, I was like, I'm keeping up with these adults. And I had no reason to think that I would. So no one was more surprised than me when I booked the show. But yeah, that is a direct correlation with the training that I was getting at Philadelphia, at Freedom Theater, at Kariamu and Company, which was this African dance company that I was dancing with. It was just, I was getting opportunities everywhere I looked to perform and to train.
Leslie, I was going to ask you if you ever get back to Philly, but you are coming back to Philly because you're hosting the Welcome America show on Ben Franklin Parkway on July 4th.
I can't wait. I hope that I get to perform a little bit. We're just trying to work out scheduling for that, if we can get a rehearsal in. But I'm so excited. It's a strange experience kind of being in this center of this hurricane, only 2 hours away. But the schedule is such that, you know, I'm so close but so far from Philadelphia. So I'm going to take the day and I'm going to come to Philly and I'm going to see family and friends. And I hope people will come out and people that I haven't seen in many years and just say hello.
Thank you so much for spending some time and talking with us. And the best of luck on June 12th, Tony Night.
Thank you so much.
How does a ragtag volunteer army in need of a shower somehow defeat a global superpower? How do we emerge?
Finally this evening, thousands of spectators attended last night's soccer match at the Link. But for Philadelphians uninterested in Copa America, there's another game in town. Philadelphia's Rock, Paper, Scissors League, and tomorrow is its big day. Master of Ceremonies Anthony Iacobucci says more than 50 players will compete in the league's one-day championship, pitting this season's most dedicated players against one another in a knockout-style tourney. The prize, $1,000. Veteran player Douglas Sudia has won other trophies and says he's considered a legend of the league, but he's never been champ. After 8 years, he thinks it's about time.
The money is great, but at this point, I want that trophy. I want that designation that I was a former champion.
He'll take a shot at the championship tomorrow evening in Connie's Rick Rack. There'll also be a side tournament for walk-ons, and if you decide to play, one organizer suggests you keep your scissors sharp and upright, keep your papers flat, and rock on. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Vinyakov and Kimberly Haas, with additional production this week from Brett Rader. We had help from our intern, Edward Saakashvili. Our news director is Eugene Song. At the controls this week, Al Banks and Diana Martinez. John Mussoni is acting vice president of news and civic dialogue. Listen again to a story or catch up on a missed show via podcast or online at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us and have a great weekend. I'm Dave Heller for Newsworks Tonight.